Hello, everyone. I am basically turning up literally to just to say hello and recite the usual beginning of podcast catechism out of habit, rather than because I have anything particularly new to say. Not least because me and Barry did wang on quite a bit at the start of last week's episode. Thank you so much for your well wishes, for both of us being a bit crocked, and for your patience in enjoying our episode from the vaults last week. And it was lovely to see quite a lot of you downloading it to listen again or for the first time. It's a relief to know that if either or both of our worlds fall apart, then that is a useful crutch to fall back on. Anyway, before we dive headlong into some truly awful galleries of some infuriatingly bad art, just to let you know the usual ways you can support us. I know, as I say, you will probably have heard this time and again, but myself, Barry, and the rest of the podcasting world keep banging on about it because it's the way we get more listeners and we can get a bit more support to keep this podcast going. If you think that we are worth parting with some of your hard-earned corona-proof cash with, then we'd be very pleased for you to do so at patreon.com/worstfootforward. Don't think I mentioned it last week, but since it is the new year, I've changed the currency you can give us money in, out with the old dollars, which we originally signed up to, and in with the new, robust, unshackled pound sterling. You can give as little as £2 a month, all the way up to £50 a month. No one's done that yet. Who wants to be the first to do so recklessly? I'll be honest, I can't even remember what we're offering for that. Fuck it. You give us £50 a month, you can almost ask for anything. There, that's a terrible challenge I've laid down. At the more manageable levels, chuck us £3 a month, you'll get a whole bunch of extra content. £5 a month, you can suggest a topic for the show. And just throwing this out there, there's quite a lot of people who have donated a £5 a month, and we've got in touch and said, give us a topic, and you've stayed stylishly silent. Listen, if you want to maintain your status as a silent partner, you're more than welcome. If you think, oh, I am giving them a bit of my cash, yeah, dance monkey dance, do get in touch with us on @worstfoot or worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com to let us know what topic you would like. £10 a month, you get a topic and you can come be a judge on the show, or £20 a month, you can come be a guest on the show, as is going to happen to our pal Courtney, who has started donating £20 a month, and we will be hopefully recording with her in a few weeks' time. If money is not the flavour of support you would like to give, then please do go to the podcatcher of your choice, chuck in some stars, say something extraordinarily flattering about us and the show, and it will hopefully bring the podcast to new and hitherto unexplored ears. As I said, same old message, hopefully in a slightly different and enjoyably florid packaging. That is pretty much all now, so I'm going to strip off my clothes, stand on the easel, and let all of you get your rollers and brushes ready for this week's episode about the world's worst artist.
Hello and welcome to Worstfoot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry Maxtay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. This week, you find me standing on a pedestal, naked, and holding a small sling over my left shoulder. Suffice to say, I had forgotten we were doing a podcast recording today. And alongside me is someone whose eyes usually follow me around the room, but not today, oddly. It's Ben van der Velde.
I can't take my eyes off of you, Barry Maxtay, as I try and sketch your various bulges and contours.
I am the epitome of classical beauty.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. You speak from experience because you have done some life modelling, haven't you?
I have done some life modelling, indeed. I am much better at not painting than I am at painting.
Yeah. And do you get to see the pictures of yourself that have been painted?
Yeah, it's really weird seeing people looking at the same image and coming out with wildly different interpretations of it.
Well, that's exactly the thing I was going to say, because I've got no qualms about taking my clothes off and having someone paint me, but it'd be, and it's not so much that that's a good version, that's a bad version, but seeing 10 people who can do it but have got their different styles.
Yeah, the other bad thing is that you're lying there and generally the room is quite quiet and occasionally there'll also be someone tutting to themselves going, oh, damn it, for fuck's sake. And you have to realise that they're probably critiquing their own work and not what they're looking at.
Yeah, they're not looking at you just going, oh, it's a really frustrating nipple to try and sculpt.
I've been told my nipples can be difficult to grasp.
Yeah. Before we find out more about your holiday in East Berlin, we should introduce this week's guest. Our guest this week is a terrific up-and-coming comedian who is tipped for enormous things in the future. He was born in Somalia, raised in Wales, and is now based in London, and a pioneer of the Cardiff Mogadishu circuit. He has a mighty comedy pedigree already. He was selected to perform at the Pleasance Comedy Reserve Show at the Edinburgh Festival, was a finalist of the BBC Introducing Radio 4 Comedy Award, and a winner of the Leicester Square New Comedian of the Year. Since then, he's appeared alongside Harry Hill on his Club Night show on Channel 4, being selected by Penguin Random House to write and perform for their Fringe audiobook, Edinburgh Unlocked, and has written for Radio 4's Now show. He is clearly as versatile as a Swiss Army knife and as straight and true as the bow that fired it. Please welcome the wonderfully funny Mo Omar.
Hello, hi there, hi. I was while you guys were talking, I was enjoying your bit of banter, and then I heard Cardiff Mogadishu circuit, and I've been trying to figure out what the connections were, because yeah. it just jumped between those things. I was like, oh no, he's introducing me now. He's not. Yeah. He's not the East.
It does sound like a very strange bit of Cold War intel that you just heard there.
Not only that, but then you mentioned Swiss Army knife, and you thought, don't add in more nationalities, you'll just confuse matters even further.
Yeah. I have to point out, Mo, because obviously we've worked together a few times. Barry hasn't met you before, and before we spoke to you, he did go, can I just check, it's not Moomar, is it? It's Mo Omar.
No. It's Mooma was one of the failed nicknames. There's a graveyard of nicknames I've had, and Mooma was the less. There's Mooma. There was Shed Boy. There was H2O.
Why H2O?
H2O, because a boy asked me in class, "What does H2O stand for?" I answered him, and he went, "Look at big words over there. He knows what H2O is." And then tried to start.
That's so cruel. Hang on, you asked me what it meant and then knowing.
Yeah, yeah. And then he wanted to mock me, and he needed just a bit of he needed a little bit of rope so he could hang me with it.
Did he also give you the nickname Shed Boy because he needed you to explain the structural integrity of a shed?
No, Shed Boy came along because when I first started school, I got into a fight, and then the teachers tried to stop me, and I just about like slipped out of their hands when they were trying to grab me, and I climbed up a shed, and they couldn't grab onto me, and I kept kicking their hands away, and I refused to come down until my mum came to school. This was primary school. Imagine that, I was 28 years old.
Imagine if you hadn't won that award at Leicester Square. He'd be still up in the lighting rig.
As long as they promised to give me the award, yeah. I would come down.
To be fair, at a primary school age, to fully clamber on top of a shed is pretty, you know, heroic.
I was very lithe. I was a very lithe child. Also, when you have those weird feats of strength as a kid, do you remember that when you could just do something like you've heard of like the mother who can pick up a car? Mm. I've got a mother's energy and hips since the lockdown.
I think when I was a kid, I fully jumped down the flight of stairs in my house on like several occasions. And now now as a 35-year-old standing at the top of those stairs, I'm like, no, what are you? I'd go, there's a window at the end of the stairs. So you'd go out the window. But also, how does anyone's knees withstand that?
I mean, that is insane. That sounds like you blacked out and your brain just pulled out the memory. Because that's like when I jumped off a bunk bed trying to do Superman.
Yeah.
And the next thing I remember was I just had no two front teeth. and my brain has just filled in the thing. But from what I've been told, my sister just found me passed out on the floor, face down. Oh my God. And then just like, also, she didn't pick me up. She then went, Mom, Mo jumped off the bunk bed, and then my mum had to go. So she went and grassed me up while I was passed out.
The
so that sounds like you jumped a whole flight of stairs. Did you live in a bungalow?
Is that the yeah. It? Yeah. It was the front doorstep. Yeah.
So we have discovered so far, Mo, that you are a master of many different pseudonyms, identities and nicknames, and indeed an absolute goddamn daredevil when you were a kid. But what is it that you are worst at in the world?
Oh, I'm worst at... I've basically lived the life of a background character. Do you know those? I'm the worst at sticking at anything. So I've
it's nice to know you won't be clucking up the comedy circuit for many more years then.
No, exactly. It has been very much an annoyance of mine. I've very much overstayed my welcome. personally, I feel like I like there's nothing like a good exit, and I'm the worst at a second act. I'm very much a first act kind of character. Like, I'm there at the good time. Do you know, in the first act when everyone's having fun
yeah.
and things can only get better? I'm that character. And then I'm the worst at sticking around in the second act. And people are like, we need to push through this. Boop, I'm gone. I'm going to go find a first actor elsewhere. I'm the worst at the second act.
That's you're like the Jar Jar Binks. Like, you get the
oh, yeah.
yeah, yeah, you're like, okay, I'm going to be in the happy episode of this, and then I'm going to go wander off and be in... I'm now imagining Jar Jar Binks showing up in The Godfather Part 1.
Yeah, yeah. It would be...
Minions Part 1.
Green screen me in
yeah.
to most things, just in the first 10 minutes of every film, when... Do you know, like, in what's it called, The Wolf of Wall Street?
Yeah.
I would be the janitor who got a bit of a raise. And so I'm just like, I'm enjoying that. And then when things start to collapse... I'm like, oh, guys, I found a job elsewhere. I'll see you guys later.
I'm now imagining Jar Jar Binks alongside Jonah Hill masturbating into a swimming pool. So thanks for that.
I mean, I can assure you there is a dark part of the internet where someone has absolutely created that.
So this week... we are talking about the world's worst artist, and I imagine that we will be crossing various different media and genres and different periods in the artistic development of the humankind, and Ben is going to give us his first impressions.
Yes, I am. Let's just get it out of the way early, gentlemen. Let's talk about the Hitler in the room, because... obviously, very famously, the three things that Hitler is most famous for, in no particular order, it goes genocide, vegetarianism, painting. Sure, there's mustaches, there's armbands, he liked a snooze and a silly walk, and obviously, most famously, he's the person that killed Hitler. But... he was famously a painter, and he produced hundreds of works and sold paintings and postcards whilst he lived in Vienna between 1908 and 1913. And in his autobiography, the rip-roaring Mein Kampf that soared to the top of the Daily Mail bestseller list in 1925...
He just
2019. Yes. He described how he wanted to become a professional artist, and he failed the entrance examination to the Academy of Fine Arts in Vienna. He was rejected twice, and he passed the preliminary portion where he was assigned to draw a couple of iconic classical or biblical scenes, but it was the second part that he failed, and that was his prepared portfolio. It was noted, according to what I've read, that his work contained too few heads. I don't know that's because he wasn't any good at portraiture or he had an obsession with the French Revolution.
Did he do like The Last Supper and there's only like seven apostles that have faces? The rest of them just have insert face later written in.
Yeah. Of course Hitler didn't draw The Last Supper. It's a painting of 12 Jews.
Yeah. 13.
I... Oh, sorry, yes.
Was the betrayer a Jew as well?
Yeah, Judas was a Jew. They were all Jewish.
I don't know why I said that, like, I might know different. Okay.
Okay. No, mate, I understand. Like, you basically, you read about the virgin birth, and then after that you're like, well, that's Act 1 done with. I'm out of here.
I know how this story turns out.
Darth Vader is Jesus' father. Yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting with Hitler stuff is that when you find out that someone's a god-awful genocidal dictator, surprise, guys. Or, like, obviously, because Mo's appreciation of World War II is, all Mo knows about is the phony war from 1939 to 1940, when nothing very much happened. Mo, I've got a lot to tell you about Act 2 and Act 3 of the Second World War. Like, TLDR, I'm lucky to be here. But when you think of someone as despicable as Hitler, you're like, surely he can't have had great talent. But technically, they are reasonable paintings to look at. There's countryside scenes that are very acceptably painted and drawing. There's one of buildings. The problem is that the way he was criticised by a member of the Vienna Art Academy, John Gunter, he said they're prosaic, devoid of rhythm, colour, feeling, spiritual imagination. They are more a piece of painful and precise draftsmanship than anything else. And all of his professors said to him, you should go and be an architect, which is a perfectly reasonable profession. But Hitler was clearly like, I don't want to be an architect. I want to be a painter. And there is a bit of a risk that some of his stuff is unduly tainted by his later legacy, which I think is me being very kind to Hitler. Yeah.
Yeah. Now listen, it's very easy to understand the frustrations of an artist who gets rejection. Many's the time I've walked out of an audition having not gotten the job and thought, I am going to invade Poland now.
Yeah.
I was actually in a similar situation where I had applied for the foundation and art course, and then they make you bring your portfolio along. And then you sit there for ages, and you go through different interviews. And the last one is when the head course person like opens your thing up, and then she just critiques it in front of you.
Mm.
I'm not saying his later actions were justified, but the level of like the belittling that they put you through, the what's it called? I don't know what point I'm trying to make. That is, I've just painted myself into a corner here.
You've painted it very beautifully though.
Then I got into my course.
But there you go. That's possibly saving millions of lives.
Well, that's it. It's a theme throughout history. Hitler's the most famous one, but obviously Genghis Khan didn't get into dance college. Like, if he'd have succeeded on Mongolia's Strictly Got Talent, then the Golden Horde simply wouldn't have paraded across the steppe.
What I find really interesting is that Churchill also painted. Like, the two big leaders on both sides of the Allies were, like, in their spare time, would just, like, go off and do, you know, some watercolours. Churchill did loads of paintings of his, particularly in the garden of Chartwell, his house.
Mm-hmm. just his house?
Yeah. I think he did, like, 6 or 7 paintings of the same view. Like, he did a lot of, like, doing the same view over and over again.
He owned the house. Why would you paint your own house? I would covet my neighbour's house. If my neighbour would always see me paint, he'd be like, stop painting my house. I'd be like, I'll have it one day.
Maybe it was, like, a massive, like, rivalry between the two of them. There was nothing to do with geopolitics. It's just like, which of us is the better painter? No one could agree. Yeah. Well, let's have a war about it.
Like one of those high school rivalries.
It got out of hand.
Yeah, where the jock enters the... Do you know those films like Save the Last Dance? Where the jock enters the arena of the nerd.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they have to... Although I imagine World War II was less like a American high school film.
The Americans only showed up about after the end of the first act, actually, Mo.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you look in all, you know, those like Netflix documentary, World War II in colour, if you look, every American soldier is holding a little red cup full of beer.
Toga.
So, yeah.
I love it that World War II was just a frat party that got out of hand. The Nazis make a lot more sense if you think of them as just the worst fraternity house in the world. One last thing about Hitler. This may be untrue, but a war museum in Norway located some paintings with the initials AH on, and the director, William Hackvarg, is convinced that these coloured images were painted by him in the very late 1930s or early 1940. They are pictures of two of the seven dwarfs as depicted by Walt Disney. And there is a painting of Doc and a painting of Bashful that he claims were painted by Adolf Hitler.
They could also equally have been painted by Anthony Hopkins or Audrey Hepburn, so let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Wait, Walt Disney and Hitler, were they around the same time?
No, they were around at the same time. They didn't work together, although they may have had similar views about the chosen people, although I don't think Walt Disney wanted necessarily to exterminate the Jewish race. It is unclear as to whether Hitler told the people running Auschwitz whether they should whistle while they work. That, incidentally, was the first draft of What Should Be Above the Gates rather than Arbach Mac Fry. We may have to edit that out so I don't get haunted by my grandparents.
And also afterwards, you'll have to explain that to me.
Oh, sorry. Arbach macht frei is German for work makes you free, which is what was written above the gates of Auschwitz.
Seriously.
Because I hate to tell you this, Mo, Nazis, not great guys.
Not great guys.
Spoiler alert.
What did you say earlier? TLDR.
Yeah.
We never actually visited. We went on one of those, what's it called, interrailing trips. But I stopped off in Austria-Hungary, because I got ill, because I was smoking cigarettes the whole way through the trip, and I wasn't eating anything. So I never made it to Poland, because we were going all the way across.
Of course you didn't make it all the way to Poland. You only like Act One.
Yeah, that was the only fun part. Interrailing is, after a while, just feels like a migrant being a refugee backwards. and I just felt like it was offensive to my parents that I was that my friends were like, oh, we'll really rough it, and I'm like, I came here not to rough it. Apologies for my lack of knowledge.
No, that's absolutely fine. Let's talk about something that everyone knows about. There have been many artists throughout history who have used poop as a media in which to create artwork. Perhaps most infamous is a 1961 artwork by the Italian artist Piero Manzoni called Artist Shit, or in Italian, Merda d'Artista. And it is not just any old pile of poo, it is 90 tin cans, each of which are reportedly filled with 30 grams of his own feces, with a label in Italian, English, French and German, and it states this: artist shit, contents 30 grams net, freshly preserved, produced and tinned in May 1961. And it was part of a number of series of works of art. Also includes another one, Fiato d'Artista, the artist's breath. It was inspired when his father, who owned a cannery, is said to have told his son, your work is shit. And so Manzoni went, all right then, Dad, since you say that. Lads, do you want to have a guess how much a tin of his shit sold for at Sotheby's in 2007?
Oh, my God.
It'll be saddening.
I'm imagining it costs quite a lot more than a tin of Heinz baked beans does.
Yes.
Maybe 200 quid?
I'm going six figures, like £300,000.
And it was 124,000 euros.
That's disgusting.
Yeah,
that is one apocalypse prepper who is really desperate, isn't it?
Any canned good.
Any canned good.
It gets better. One of the artist's friends, Agostino Banalumi, claimed that the tins are not actually full of feces, but just plaster. And because the cans are steel, they cannot be x-rayed or scanned, so it cannot be verified what's inside them without opening them. But obviously, it's like being a collector of Star Wars miniatures. The minute you open it, it's invalidated. Except if you're an artist, Bernard Bazile exhibited an open can of artist shit in 1989 under the title An Opened Can of Piero Manzoni. And it contained an unidentifiable wrapped object.
I don't know if I would be disappointed or not disappointed if I had bought a can and it didn't have shit. It's like Schrodinger's shit. Is it while the can is closed, we don't know if the shit is there or not, and in many ways I'm happier not having that knowledge.
I think you should be, and I'm going to annoy you even more now when I tell you about another exhibition of this artwork. In the mid-1990s, a museum in Randers in Denmark was accused by the art collector John Hunoff of causing a leakage of one of the cans because it had been displayed incorrectly. It had been stored at irresponsibly high temperatures. The lawsuit ended with the museum having to pay a settlement to the collector to the tune of 250,000 Danish kroner.
Why?
Because they'd ruined this artwork.
Oh my god.
I would just say no.
I pity the poor restorationist who's then called into, can you restore this can with shit inside it, please? He's used to like recoloring Matisse's, and instead he gets this shit. Funnily enough, I just want to link your first two things you've mentioned, Ben, because there's a German artist called Martin von Ostrovsky who paints using feces and semen. And he first made the news when he created a painting of Adolf Hitler using his own poo.
Glorious. I think I saw, if not him, then someone else he paints with poo and semen. And to be honest, they're really great reproductions. There's another guy who I was going to mention, but I'll mention him only very briefly in passing. A guy called Tim Patch, who his moniker is Picasso, because he paints using his penis as a brush. And I was going to chat more about him, but the paintings are really good. Like, he can paint better with his dick than I can with my hand.
I might tell people a bit about him in a bit. So his paintings are distressingly accurate.
Yeah. Are they expensive as well?
I don't know, actually. That's a very good question. He's more contemporary. He's still active at the moment, so they'll probably get
like
more.
A flasher.
Yeah. He's still at large.
I mean, if I was going to paint with my penis, the only style I'd do is pointillism. But for my choice, we're going to talk about, surprise, surprise, a conceptual artist.
Yeah.
And this is a chap called Chris Burden. And at the age of 12, he had to have emergency surgery performed without anaesthesia on his left foot, which had been severely injured in a scooter crash. And after that, during his convalescence, he became interested in visual arts and photography. And I'm going to let you lads decide whether this accident had a real effect on him in his later life. So Chris Burden's first piece was called 5-Day Locker Piece. And in this, he lived inside a student locker for 5 days.
Yeah.
In the lockers above and below him, there was a 5-gallon water container and an empty container for urine that was attacked to him by hoses. He fasted for several days. And outside of the locker, students and teachers argued about the project's merits, which I think is a very diplomatic way of saying they bitched about him and what a nutter he was.
I just want to get my fucking book, okay? There's someone stopping you from getting into your locker because some old dude is inside.
Or even better, he accidentally locked himself inside, and for 5 days his colleagues thought that he was creating an art piece and were debating it outside. And he's like, please let me out.
Yeah, he's just no. That would be so sad if they didn't know he was in there, yeah. And they're like, "Have you heard about?" Because they thought he was in the other lockers, and they're like, "Have you heard about that fucking idiot?"
I mean, this is basically David Blaine, but
yeah,
three, four decades early.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, he's referred to in many by one journalist as durational daredevil, which is one way of saying attention-seeking prick. The next year, he did a piece of work called Shoot, where he was filmed in a gallery in Santa Ana, standing against a wall. A friend raised a .22 caliber rifle at a distance of 15 feet and shot him in the left shoulder. Apparently, this was all about the Vietnam War. Of course it was, and about bystander culture and American gun culture. And he has so many other pieces that are similarly brutal like this. He has one called Dead Man, where he lay on the ground covered with a canvas sheet and a set of road flares until bystanders assumed he was dead and called the emergency services.
Oh my God.
There was Match Piece, in which he lit matches and threw them at a naked woman lying between him and a set of two televisions covered with butcher's paper. TV Hijack, where during a live television interview, he brought his own camera crew to. He held the interviewer, Phyllis Lutyens, hostage at knife point and threatened to kill her if the station stopped live transmission. What?
Would he have done it, do you think?
He did it. Oh, sorry, would he have killed her? He actually did. And his next piece was called Jailbird and lasted 27 years.
While outside of his cell, all the other prisoners and the guards debated the merits of the current piece.
Oh, that was great.
I really liked 747. I read a bit about him as well. Did you read about 747, Ben?
No.
747 was a piece he did in, I say piece, with a voice dripping with sincerity. In 1973, he fired several pistol shots directly at a Boeing 747 taking off from Los Angeles Airport.
That's just an act of domestic terrorism.
Correct, yes.
Right. Yeah. Precisely, that is yet another marvellous example of white privilege.
Yeah.
What are you doing? I'm just firing a gun at a plane. Why? Art. All right. No further questions.
Alternative answer. Why? America.
Yeah. Fair. Very fair. A couple of others before I tell you about the piece de resistance that will make you all flinch. Has one called BC Mexico, where he kayaked to a desolate beach in Baja, Mexico, where he lived for 11 days without food or water. Mate, your parents love you. Stop it.
Yes. It's just spring break, man.
Yeah. In 1976, he did Do You Believe in Television, in which he sent an audience to the third floor of a building where television monitors show them the ground floor, and he then lit a fire on the ground floor. I kind of like that one. And then by 1979, he clearly ran out of ideas, where he created Honest Labour, in which he dug a large ditch.
I feel like this guy was a troll. And was the internet around? No, it wasn't around.
Yeah, it wasn't around.
He just didn't have 4chan yet.
Yeah.
This feels like a 4chan user who just hasn't found his people yet. Like, especially the last one.
It is a bit of an incel cry for help, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
The one that really makes me wince is one called Transfixed, which you may have heard of in folklore. On April the 23rd, 1974, at the Speedway Avenue in Venice, California, he lay face up on a Volkswagen Beetle and had nails hammered into both of his hands as if he were being crucified on the car. And the car was pushed out the garage and the engine revved for 2 minutes before being pushed back in.
Oh, God. I mean,
why? Just, you're right. Like, your parents love you. Come home. Come home. So,
right?
Your weeping mother. Come on, please. This has huge pseudo-intellectual vibes.
Mm.
It does. I think the fact that it was on a Volkswagen, which is also obviously the people wagon, which was a car designed in Nazi Germany, that I think he was trying to make a very blunt piece of criticism there.
This is like when I interviewed an artist and he was talking about his work with the refugees, and it was an ironic piece itself, because he didn't know that I had been a refugee, and he was explaining to me how hard refugees have it and how he had spent time on a boat and therefore could empathize with the people coming over on ships and on the floors. And there were levels, and that would be a piece of conceptual art. which because he's like a North London artist explaining to me how.
You should have said, "Mate, I can tell you how hard refugees have it because I have to listen to you."
Yeah. But it was like he was being sincere, and you could tell that he had all the best intentions. Which with this guy, it seems to be the. Do you know when someone overthinks something, and therefore then the basic tenets of what's normal. Like it's too close. You get too close to the idea, and therefore you end up being someone who just shot a gun at a plane.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter what point you were making. You were essentially shooting a gun at a plane, and if people, no one had reminded him. No, what you did was you shot a gun at a plane. No, what I was doing was I was trying to. No.
What you actually
you took
did?
A gun, yeah, and you shot at a plane. You shot at people at a Boeing plane. What did you think you'd achieve? Actually, don't answer that. Yeah. We feel like you'll have an answer. We're just going to try you on what we've seen you do.
Yeah.
Because, let me remind you one more time for the audience. He shot at them at a plane.
He's clearly a man who was never told no as a child.
Mine is a much more well-known figure,
mm-hmm.
but it does follow in the same footsteps as who you're talking about. Mine was the person I wanted. So I had two. One is a fictional artist. He was one of my honourable mentions, who is Lipiat in Antique. So he's a character who I read when I was around 17. Basically, this character in this book, who when he was.
We should say that Antique is written by Aldous Huxley.
Yes, correct. Yeah. Basically, he's this character who, when he was young, he said that no great piece of art is ever made by anyone over the age of 40, and then he turned 40, and then he went, except for me.
And that sounds like Stuart Lee talking about stand-up comedy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's no self-awareness. And he's basically the sort of pastiche of what an artist is. So he considers himself like he's a painter, he's a poet, he's all these different things. Because he always did these things where he would start every poem. He would just, on the drop of a hat, he would recite himself a poem that he'd made up. But all his poems would start in the same way, which were, "O conquistador, looking upon your field of dreams." And they were all really, like, really bland, really, like, they lacked any... And every other character knew how idiotic he actually is. But no one ever had the heart to tell, which is the kind of insecurity any artist really feels, is what if everyone's just being nice to me?
Yeah.
but the ones who don't have that imposter syndrome... are the ones who end up being that. So it's basically a comment on that. But also he did the kind of things where if someone knocked on his door, he would basically he wouldn't answer straight away. He would wait so that they would think he was so deep in his work that he couldn't even hear the door. And so he would wait for like 5 minutes and then he'd answer, and he would make sure that he looked like he was all disheveled. So that was my honourable mention.
That is he sounds quite like Donald Trump in the way that like he has to mm-hmm. pretend at being president. Like the things presidents do is they start wars and they sit behind desks with generals around them and they give speeches to crowds and nobody can solve this possibly apart from me, and when someone wins by this amount in the electoral college it's a landslide except when it's not me, and obviously you know I will concede if I win the election and all of these things. Like he's like changes the rules to suit himself. That.
I love the idea of him, you said start wars, of him giving his general a post-it note with his ideas, that it's like, one, start wars, two, yeah. like, But they start so extreme, and the third one is like, and also they do speeches.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
why was war your first one? Maybe we should flip the post-it note around, sir. Yeah. No. Number one, we start wars. But yeah, he just reminded me of what everyone is, should be afraid of becoming in terms of like the world's worst. So that's my honorable mention. But the one I want to pick as my main one is Steve Jobs. For ruining a whole generation, for ruining a few generations of people, of creatives at all, by pretending basically an industrialist in an artist's clothes. and basically I hate the idea that, because I remember when I was younger I had his book, everyone read his book, and he was just basically a professional thief, but he made you think that the way artists create work, they see something they like, and they take it, and that's how he basically programmed all. And also, he created this whole culture in Silicon Valley, of basically the tech guys who pretend to be creative souls, really, yeah. And then. It tricked me, someone who has not a technical bone in his body, to try and learn how to code. and I just resent the fact that I couldn't do it. And yet those guys get to walk around in beads and talk about spirituality.
I really like that you say he's basically, you know, he's an industrialist in artist's clothes and a professional thief. Because essentially, artist and thief are the two genres of people who get to wear those black roll necks.
He's a good example of, and you were talking about this, like the same thing. Although I was gonna pick Duchamp, but you as a conceptual artist, and Tracy Emmons and the whole YBA, because they tricked me into, they also fooled me into thinking art was basically whatever you want it to be, and that's not true. You have to also be able to do art. Like you can't, like I did. I went to a foundation in art course. I lasted until lunchtime.
Can I suggest that art is actually whatever you can get away with charging?
Yes, no. And no one had given me that distinction, okay? I thought I'd gone into this art course thinking, basically, just do what you want. But the reality is, do what you want as long as you can justify it. Basically, another honorable mention then, yes, would be the YBA.
These are the young British artists.
Yes, yeah, because that whole movement made me think that basically, you do have to also do the work. It can't just be like the. That's why I have the problem with that conceptual artist guy, is that sometimes a nice picture is nice. Like it shouldn't. Things don't have to be hard. You don't have to go shoot at a plane. You can just pick up a pencil, make a nice picture. You're overselling what the role of the artist is sometimes, and it can get, but my main one is Steve Jobs, because he's the world's worst artist, because he was a Lipiat who got away with it. He's basically someone who, because everyone's like, he was the unlikely one, he was sleeping on a couch in his friends, yeah, he was a loser who found someone to take the work off, and and he managed to build a career. After that, maybe he got smarter. But I don't like this whole like idea of, because who was the other guy? Who was the guy who was with him?
Steve Wozniak.
Yeah, everyone talks about how like, without him, Wozniak would have. No, Wozniak would have been fine. This is how you should look at things. You should look at it in a sliding doors thing. Without Wozniak, Steve Jobs would have been just a nobody. It's like Hitler. It's not like Hitler.
Yeah, Hitler who created the Heil phone.
Come on.
Yeah, you had to do one really large swipe to make it work.
But when the iPhone came out, people did talk about it as like a work of art, and similarly the iMac, when they appeared, people were like, oh, they're not just machines, they're works of art. And that was like Apple's whole branding approach to it.
Yeah, he's a great salesman, he's an industrialist, and he's managed to, did you see that picture, that thing? It's like when Russell Brand did that Messiah Complex thing, which was supposed to be a self-aware piece of work, but really was just him putting his face next to other great leaders, And so, like, and this isn't a point I've made before. This isn't my point, but Bill Burr also says, like, Steve Jobs, he went, Gandhi, Martin Luther, me? And he just put his face next to it. And you're just supposed to infer that they're all leaders in their own kind of way. I know it's not.
He hired good people as well. Yes. It's not just like, it's a bit Trumpy. It's that thing of putting one person up on the pedestal and saying the whole reason something happens is this person. You go, you hired good people, but there are loads of other people who, you know, designed the damn thing and made it work and all that. And there are so many drawing apps and painting apps on tablets and things these days. Have you used any of them? Because there's a bit of me finds them that quite odd.
Because you can't, although reality in itself could be a simulation, but I feel like the way it works is it's predicting, it's through your movement, it's predicting where you want to be. So can it really ever be a painting of your own? When, which is the shittiest philosophy class ever. That's which the person, completely uncredited. No one has allowed me to do it. I just hacked the website and now my course is on. But yeah, I don't think it can ever be truly a painting. But at the same time, you can, like, can a person who paints without someone paint with a robotic hand? That's a good question. Like, because that is in itself guessing where you want to go. So is it ever just you? But your hand, is your hand ever you? Oh, man. Now we've gone, we've strayed onto the off the garden path.
I haven't smoked enough for this conversation, Mo.
I'm sorry. But yeah, that's my world's worst artist. And I feel like he's the world's worst artist because, like every bad artist, what he was actually doing had nothing to do with art, but he just managed to sell it as such.
Ben, you mentioned Tim Patch, Picasso, a little bit more about him. Yeah, he paints using his penis, but also his scrotum and his buttocks. He's not restricted to just one medium. And he does portraits and landscapes. And I looked it up. He sells commissions for between $300 and $1,000. And he's been doing this since 2005. He saw the Australian comedy, they're Australian, I think, Puppetry of the Penis.
Yeah.
The comedy group Puppetry of the Penis. And he thought, that's interesting. Yeah, there's a group called Puppetry of the Penis who do literally puppetry with the penis. So they believe, like, they manage to squeeze their balls and penises into, like, faces. And
I know a number of different acts who have opened for them, but also the phrase, I opened for Puppetry of the Penis, feels like a pretty loaded phrase.
Yeah. he's managed to come up with, you know, his own type of paint so it doesn't irritate his penis, which normal paint would do. And he has done portraits of various celebrities, including Hugh Hefner, George W. Bush, Robert Mugabe, Barack Obama, Kevin Rudd, Tony Blair, Lula, the former president of Brazil, and Queen Elizabeth II. Which I would love to see her being, like, you know, occasionally she has an official portrait painted. You always get the photo of her beside the painting with the artist. You know, I really want to see him.
Does he get close to the canvas?
He uses his penis like he would use a brush.
How big is his penis?
I have to say, having seen a photo, not enormous.
That is dedication. What an he's essentially just rubbing up against it.
Yeah, I mean, there is a Danish artist called Uwe Max Jensen who also paints with his penis. And he actually has said in an interview that larger penises are better for painting because they can recreate small details which smaller penises can't.
Larger penises reach the places that smaller penises cannot.
That's what he was saying, yeah. It's a dick joke, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, another technical question, is he circumcised? Because I just feel that a circumcised penis will give you more options.
Most Australians are, and Picasso, Tim Patch is Australian, so,
You wouldn't want it to be circumcised, would you?
I don't know. Maybe you wouldn't, because then you'd have the option of using the foreskin or not.
Yeah, as a sort of, like, a blending.
Yeah.
What, as, like, I don't have a palette knife, but I can just...
I can't believe I'm actually having to say this, but just in case any listeners at home are tempted to try and do this. Please don't paint with your penises or any genitals, because paint can be highly corrosive.
However, if you donate to our Patreon page at $100 a month,
we'll do it. Yeah. I know Ben and I have both read about Milo Moray. She's a Swiss conceptual artist and model who also, you know, streams daily pornography on her website for a fee. She likes to blend the boundaries between art and porn, she says. She's Swiss, and one of her most famous pieces is a performance art piece called Plop Egg, where she fills eggs with ink and acrylic paint and then plops them out of her vagina onto a canvas, creating an abstract work of art.
Creating the world's weirdest eggs, Benedict.
Yeah. She tends to then fold the canvas on itself and then open it again, a bit like a Rorschach test.
I'm glad I didn't eat before this.
Yeah. I was just thinking that it being called Plop Egg, I really hope, long-term listeners of the podcast, you'll enjoy this, that she has been influenced and inspired by Theophilus Marsyals, the world's worst poet, who famously wrote a poem called Plop.
Yeah, they should definitely work together on something.
Saying plop, that is the... Plop. It's making me nauseous.
Maybe you'd prefer this piece then, Mo. In June 2014, she did a piece called The Script System Number 2, where she went to an exhibition at Art Basel, naked, but just with the names of items of clothing written on her body in paint.
That's great. I really like that.
So being a conceptual artist is basically being a troll with a degree.
Yeah. In case people aren't aware, the idea of conceptual art is that it's not the technical skill behind the art piece isn't the important thing. It's whatever the idea behind the art piece is.
Do you know what? Conceptual artists need to have a long, hard conversation with themselves and admit that they're just prop comics without a decent 10 minutes.
I think you would read...
One moment. I think my fridge is open.
Okay.
Is it, or is it just a piece of conceptual art?
Yeah. when did fridges become members of the household?
That's since they got smart.
Sounds like a McIntyre bit, like they fucking screamed all the time.
It really does, doesn't it?
You might also then, Ben, if you like that, she did a piece in 2016 called Mirror Box, where she walked around various European cities with a large mirrored structure covering her body, using a megaphone to attract passers-by, and then invited them to stick their hands into the box and fondle her breasts or her vulva for 30 seconds.
30 seconds is a long time.
Yeah. She was copying a piece, it seems, by a lady called Valley Export from the 60s and 70s called Touch and Tap Cinema, where she basically did the same thing. She wore a little movie theatre around her naked upper body, so people could reach through the curtains at the front of the theatre and touch her breasts. Being the 60s, the media responded to her work with panic and fear, with one newspaper calling her a witch.
Witch is the quickest... That's a ridiculous thing to jump to. Like they hadn't had an update yet.
Yeah.
For what stood for crazy woman yet.
Yeah.
So which is the last word we use?
Still the one word we've got. I really like this piece. There's a piece by Mark Quinn in the National Portrait Gallery in London called Self, where he uses 9 pints of his own blood and uses it to mold a sculpture of his own head. And he remakes the piece every 5 years with new blood and does a new mold of his face. To show his body aging in real time.
Well, what is it called? Let me just check.
It's called Self. It's just a self-portrait. They run, I think, an electric charge through it to keep the sort of the freezing. I don't understand the technology behind how they keep it live and all of that. But yeah, it's always running with a slight refrigeration and an electric charge. It's really cool. It's a really interesting piece. And Mark Quinn is an interesting artist, I think. Grant Wood, maybe more famous name, he's the one who created American Gothic, the painting of the two serious-looking folk outside the building that people all know. His studio is really interesting. When you came to the top of the stairs in the house where his studio was, there's a door which is an old coffin lid, because the studio was next door to a mortuary. And so he asked them if he could use a coffin. They'd give him a coffin lid to make the door into his studio. He painted glass on the window as a clock face, and the hands could be turned to times where there would be messages written at different points in the clock saying he was painting or taking a bath or having a party. So it's a, like a, I'm showing what he was up to inside the thing, like a do not disturb sign, but more versatile than that.
Like an elaborate sock on the door.
Yeah. you mentioned Dali, I think very briefly earlier on. Dali was the subject to a paternity case, which was filed 26 years after he died. A woman called Maria Pilar, who's an astrologist and tarot reader, which just seems very appropriate. She said her mother had an affair with Dali when she met him at a younger age, and she called for his body to be exhumed so she can prove that she's his daughter. I don't think that's been resolved yet. But Dali himself had a weird idea of his own.
How do you prove that when he's already dead? Is it like when you put a puppy in the middle between two people?
Yeah.
Come here, boy. Come here, boy. See which one is the owner.
So yeah, like, I presume they'll have to exhume it and do some DNA tests. But when he was younger, he had a weird, like, idea of where he'd come from as well. He was five, and his parents took him to the grave of his brother. His older brother had died before Dali was born. And Dali's parents told him he was the reincarnation of his older sibling, who he'd never met, who was also called Salvador. And Salvador Dali came to believe he was indeed his older brother's reincarnation, and paints him into several of his own paintings, including Portrait of My Dead Brother. Weird guy, Dali. TLDR. He also loved cooking. He released a cookbook called Le Dîner de Gala in 1973. Well, it's obviously a very surreal cookbook. It's got lots of weird illustrations and, you know, frogs being stabbed and a swan and a toothbrush and a pastry case and things like that. And he billed it as an erotic cookbook, and it has a chapter on aphrodisiacs and recipes which include the Casanova cocktail. He basically, in the introduction, he says, if you're a disciple of one of those calorie counters who turn the joys of eating into a form of punishment, close this book at once.
And that's how we got away with not writing anymore.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it has lots of recipes. And actually, reading the recipes, they're laid out as proper recipes, but there are they are for things like 1,000-year-old eggs and toffee with pine cones and frog pasties and so on.
Oh, that's how you get away with it. That's when you, do you know how those normal, like those Instagram chefs, like you all have this particular instrument that no one in the world has except professional chefs. Dali was the first one. He was the first Instagram chefs.
Just reach into the cupboard, get out your 1,000-year-old eggs. Everyone has them in the back of the cupboard somewhere. Weird coincidence, Francis Bacon, he struggled a lot with insomnia and he took a lot of pills, but he also, in an effort to try and help himself fall asleep, he would read classic cookbooks to help lull himself to sleep. Obviously more famous for his hedonistic lifestyle, but I love the idea of after a long night partying with like Lucy and Freud, he'd go home and just open up a Fanny Craddock tome and just read about how to make prawn cocktails. I really wanted to have a read about painters who are gay, and there are loads of the famous ones are, basically, or will have, or had same-sex relations, certainly. Leonardo da Vinci, a lot of people think he was asexual, but the few references he makes to sexuality in his notebooks, he expresses disgust at the act of procreation. He writes that intellectual passion drives that sensuality. Whoso curbs not lustful desires puts himself on a level with the beasts. Which may sound like asexualism, but also sounds possibly like someone, a homosexual in a very heterosexual society, trying to, you know, suppress himself. And there is one historical document about his sex life, which was an accusation of sodomy against him made in 1476 while he was still an apprentice at the workshop of Verrocchio.
Cancel culture.
Yeah. the charges were dismissed eventually, but obviously charges of sodomy were quite serious back in the day, carried the punishment of the death penalty. And he was living in Florence at the time, and Florence, the homosexuality was so rife in Florence at the time that in Germany they used the term Florencer, meaning a Florentine, as a slang for gay people.
He's a Florencer.
Yeah, exactly, total Florencer. And I read about Michelangelo as well. His nephew and namesake, also called Michelangelo, published a load of Michelangelo's poems after he died, and he altered the gender of the poems. So he'd wrote loads of poems to men. And was definitely gay. And his nephew just edited them to make them sound like they were all addressed to women instead. So he changed the names of the genders of the people they were addressed to.
There's a wonderful little proof of, not proof, but piece of evidence for Michelangelo not necessarily knowing too much about the physiognomy of women. He did a sculpture of Night, and in it, the figurine of Night has the most unplump and uninviting cleavage you have ever seen on a piece of Renaissance sculpting. They are basically two hemispheres of a blancmange with a 6-inch gap in between them. And the only explanation is that he is a man who has not seen a naked boob in quite some time.
Just loads of shrugging in the studio. Is that it? Yeah, it seems close enough.
Yeah, I mean, ish.
What it looks like.
I don't know how much action he will have gotten, because one of his servants said that he spent so much time wearing his shoes that when he eventually took them off, the skin came away like a snake's with the boots. He was not a very clean man. By all accounts.
Hanging from the ceiling.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. The Sistine Chapel, which he's famous for painting the ceiling of, he painted it standing up. He didn't paint it lying on his back. And people have this image of him on a scaffold lying on his back. And there were various ideas, like loads of... The Pope, Pope Julius II, mm-hmm. basically had loads of people come up with ideas for how they could get him up there. One guy mm-hmm. suggested hanging like platforms from the ceiling, to which Michelangelo said, "Aren't you then going to be making holes in the ceiling for the supports to be stuck into? What do I do when I try to paint where the holes are?" So eventually he designed a sort of a self-supporting platform system around the walls and things like that. And the paintings are remarkable. They cover 12,000 square feet. I mean, I feel like that's not a hot take for anyone listening to the show, by the way. The ceiling of the Sistine Chapel is quite good. That's my artistic eye speaking.
Welcome
there.
Welcome to your to your Middle Ages news. Yeah. Brought to you live.
I'm hardly Brian Sewell here. And I read, given I was reading about the turtles, I read about Raphael as well. Raphael died on his 37th birthday, either from a fever or from what one biographer describes as amatory excess, i.e. mid-sex.
Wow, do we think that basically he didn't have the cardio to stay the course?
That possibly, he was only 37, which isn't that old. But yeah, one suggestion is that he was having so much sex that he died. But it was his birthday. He was being rewarded, presumably. I just wanted to mention, you did mention briefly Marcel Duchamp earlier on, who's most famous for the urinal that people will know, which is called Fountain, which is basically a urinal turned onto its side with the pseudonym R. Mutt written on it. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed that. These are basically he made a lot of things which are called ready-mades, where he'd reappropriate existing objects in this way. Mm-hmm. So he has one where there's like a shovel, which is called in advance of the broken arm. And he did another which he had one which was coat racks and various different things. But Fountain, he presented at a showing in New York in 1917. First annual exhibition of the Society of Independent Artists. But the rumour was going around that he was going to be presenting a new painting called Tulip Hysteria Coordinating. So it sounds, and he was famous for his paintings at this point. And then suddenly when he shows up, instead of with this new painting everyone was excited about, with the fountain, there was a huge outcry. The exhibition refused to show it. And I like the idea that he spread the rumour that he's going to be presenting a new and exciting painting and then completely, punked them by showing up with this thing instead. The reason it's signed R. Mutt is he got the urinal, which he used to make the fountain, from J.L. Mott Ironworks in Fifth Avenue in New York. And then he wanted to change the name a little bit, so he came up, he thought he'd call him Richard, but we just use the initial R. And then he changed Mott to Mutt because he was reading the Mutt and Jeff cartoons at the time.
Are those newspaper cartoons?
Yeah. I think they're still running. I don't know if they're still in some. They were one of those syndicated cartoons you see in newspapers. The original fountain has disappeared. There was a photograph taken of it at a studio of the photographer Alfred Stieglitz, and then the theory is that Stieglitz maybe just threw it out, which he did to a lot of Duchamp's works. But Duchamp made some. Duchamp made some copies of it later on in his life. I also, just a couple of the things about Duchamp I really liked is he had a female alter ego called Rose Célavie. Two R's for Rose, and then Célavie written as one word, but in French it's obviously Célavie, that's life. And he would dress up as a woman and have photos taken of him by the photographer Man Ray. So there are all these amazing photos of him as Rose Célavie, and he used the name on some written material and signed several of his artworks as Rose Célavie. And he did some composing in 1968. Marcel Duchamp and John Cage appeared together at a concert entitled Reunion, playing a game of chess and composing music at the same time. They had photoelectric cells under the chessboard, which were triggered by the movements of the chess pieces. Turns out, Marcel Duchamp, massively into chess, when he went back to Paris in the 1920s, he basically was not an artist anymore. He wasn't creating anything. His main interest was chess. He entered competitions. He earned the title of chess master at the French chess championships with a 50% success rate, 3-3 with two draws. And he was so fascinated with chess that his wife glued his pieces to the chessboard to try stop.
Now that is a brilliant piece of art.
Yeah,
that is.
as a performance art piece, Marcel Duchamp trying to move glue down chess pieces. I would completely go for that. But for my world's worst artist, I have gone for also my favorite artist. I love Caravaggio, and some of Caravaggio's work is the most beautiful creations I think any man has ever created. The Taking of Christ, which is in the National Gallery in Dublin in particular, is just stunning. And he's most famous for his chiaroscuro style, which is the play between light and shadow. His use of shadow and the way light guides you around his painting is just, it's so phenomenal. But as a person to be around, absolute nightmare.
Oh, really?
Caravaggio was almost certainly bisexual. He had a relationship with men, but also his affairs with women got him into so much trouble. Everywhere he goes, he is in...
He always takes the weather with him? Sorry.
He always takes brawls with him. He's always being arrested and on trial and imprisoned. He gets into fights. And as this article notes, even at a time when such behaviour was commonplace, there are page after page after page of police records about Caravaggio. He's likely that he committed his first murder in Milan in 1590. He fled to Venice and then to Rome. In the year 1600, while living with his patron, Cardinal Del Monte, he beat a nobleman who was a guest of the cardinal's at a party with a club. He was jailed several times, including at another point for the defamation of another painter for writing offensive poems about him. The French ambassador intervened to plea for Caravaggio's release. He was arrested several times between the months of May and October 1604 for possessing weapons and insulting city guards. And he was sued by a tavern waiter for throwing a plate of artichokes into his face, which makes it sound very much like he was a really rowdy drunk. He fled to Genoa for 3 weeks in 1605 after seriously injuring another a notary, in a dispute over one of his lovers. He was sued by his landlady for not paying rent. Out of spite, he threw rocks through her window at night and was sued again. He was hospitalised for an injury which he said was him falling on his own sword. And his biggest problem...
So he was injured by a metaphor.
Yeah, yes. And his biggest problem happened in 1606. He killed another guy, a gangster called Ranuccio Tomassoni, who came from quite a wealthy family. He killed him in a duel. And they'd argued a lot. And this time they're like, okay, we're going to settle with a duel. The suggestion is made he hadn't meant to kill him, and the duel just went that way. So, but it's not
falling on the sword.
Yeah, yeah. But in this case, again, it may have been over a gambling debt or a game of tennis. The popular story is that it was over a game of tennis that this happened, possibly over another lover. But anyway, for whatever reason, apparently Caravaggio also castrated Tomassoni after killing him, and then
used his penis as a paintbrush.
Sadly not. He fled because there was a huge political background to this one, because the Tomassoni family were pro-Spanish, while Caravaggio was a client of the French ambassador, as I mentioned. So he was sentenced to beheading for murder, and an open bounty was placed on him. So he then was fleeing all across Italy. He went from Rome to just south of Rome, then to Naples, fled to Malta, where he tried to join the Knights of Malta, who they begged the Pope to pardon him. But after a few months, he was arrested and imprisoned again after another brawl with one of the aristocratic knights, during which he'd broken down the door of the knight's house.
Sorry, this is the Knights Templar we're talking about.
These are the Knights of St. John, who ran hospitals in Malta at the time. They had initially taken him in and said, actually, he's reforming his ways. They begged for forgiveness from the Pope. And even they ran out of patience with him and expelled him from the order as a foul and rotten member. Which, in fairness, apparently was a phrase they used formally when they were expelling any people, but still doesn't sound great. But yeah, for like a hugely famous painter, and he wasn't like he was a little known figure. He was representing and working for very influential people. He spent a lot of his life in trouble, and actually later on in his career, a lot of his paintings show people with severed heads. So he does ones of the head of John the Baptist and things like that, because it seems like he's obsessed with the idea of his own, you know, sentence on his head, which had been passed. And he didn't get caught. He died of, it seems like, a fever about 18 months after he'd fled from Malta. But yeah, for such a brilliant...
It doesn't sound like it's him. It's his fault.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah. Like, for such a brilliant
artist.
It's not a
bounty on his head. It's very much his fault.
Completely. it's very much great artist, but a pain in the arse to be around. The sort of guy you go, okay, we're going to have a party, but Caravaggio is going to show up, guys.
And he's going to have the St. John's ambulance.
Yeah.
So,
our three candidates for the World's Worst Artist are Ben's suggestion of Chris Burden, the man who shot a gun at a plane. That's the one thing I'm going to remember about this dude. Mo's suggestion of Steve Jobs, the professional thief. And my suggestion of Caravaggio, the party boy, talented artist, and Hellraiser. Good suggestions all around. I've picked him, and yet immediately as I start thinking of any of the works of Caravaggio, I cannot then go pick Caravaggio, because I'd love his work too much to say he's the world's worst artist. World's worst party guest, maybe, but maybe not world's worst artist. Which leaves me with Chris Burden and Steve Jobs. And much and all as I kind of agree with your argument, Mo, I don't know. I know he tried to
I'd done as much research as you guys.
I completely go with why you would say he's the world's worst artist.
I did not come here with a full suitcase for my album.
Well, no, I think what happens is you brought an iPhone to a gunfight because Chris Burden... Chris Burden, particularly for just how many annoying conceptual art pieces he did, I think... has absolutely walked it this week, as far as I'm concerned. So congratulations, 100%. Ben. Congratulations to you and to Chris Burden. He is definitely the world's worst artist.
Yeah, he hasn't walked it. He is actually driven here whilst nailed to the top of a Volkswagen Beetle.
With a brick on the accelerator so you can't slow down.
Yeah. Before we go, I've got to give you some of the world's best news of the week. And this news comes from the excellent Dicebreaker.com, the place to go to for anyone who's interested in board games and role-playing games. Former guest of the show, Johnny Chiodini, is an employee of the company. And they bring us news of the ending of a 20-year-long feud between Uri Geller and Pokemon. Mm-hmm. So, for 20 years, the illusionist Uri Geller has been... In an ongoing legal action with Pokemon, where he forced them to discontinue the use of Kadabra, one of the Pokemon, because Kadabra is pictured holding a spoon.
Oh.
And its name in Japanese is Youngerer, which is a Japanese pronunciation of Uri Geller. So Kadabra is a psychic-type Pokemon who uses, you know, psychic powers. And so obviously inspired by Uri Geller, Pokemon made the figure of Kadabra. And for 20 years, Kadabra has been missing from the Pokemon card game and from the anime programs because of this action by Uri Geller. Until a couple of Saturdays ago, he took to Twitter, apologized for his actions, and removed the legal blockade. He said, "I'm truly sorry for what I did 20 years ago. Kids and grown-ups, I am releasing the ban. It's now all up to hashtag Nintendo to bring my Kadabra Pokemon card back. It'll probably be one of the rarest cards now. Much energy and love to all. Uri Geller."
So, no, you can't 20 years. You can't fight something for 20 years and then go, whoops.
Yeah.
That's not a defense.
He says you can learn from mistakes even more than you can learn from success. Uri Geller apparently just had a huge number of emails from fans of Pokemon petitioning him to release the ban. And posted a video on Twitter on November 29th of him opening up a suitcase he originally sent to his lawyers with proof of his claim, showing several Kadabra figurines and lots of Pokemon merchandise, which makes me hope that now that the ban has been raised, Yuri Geller can finally cash in all of that Kadabra merch he's been hoarding for 20 years and sell it for hundreds of thousands of pounds on eBay. crafty Yuri Geller. Nice news for fans of Pokemon, I suppose. Well done to Yuri Geller for, you know, it's been the case of the century, and finally it's at an end. Mo, where can people find out more about you and your work?
So I'm on Twitter. I'm also on Facebook. No, I'm joking. I'm also on Instagram under MoK Ultra, like Project MK Ultra, but MoK Ultra. Thank you. I think you guys are the first people to get it. People usually. That's why I have to rattle off the explanation. So you can find us on that. You can also find me on I've got a pod called No Blacks, No Dogs, No Irish, with another comic called Vittorio Angeloni, where this very much sounds like it was the first idea and we stuck to it, which is what happened. But where we basically pick our black of the week, our dog of the week, and our Irish of the week. Very loose format. Last week we argued about why people can pronounce the word Saoirse Ronan but struggle with other names. It's like it's such a boon. It's like how it doesn't even sound like it's spelt. So I got Vittorio to explain that to me. But yeah, that's where you can find me. But thanks so much, guys. This is like this has been really fun. Now I get to go and show off like I knew this stuff.
Yeah.
We all knew Michelangelo had dirty feet.
There we go. That's the one you're gonna take away from. I'm gonna remember the guy shooting on a plane. Thank you very much, Mo. Thank you everyone else for listening. We're all off to dip our penises in paint and then piss in Marcel Duchamp's fountain. Thank you for listening to Worse from Forward. Goodbye.
Goodbye.